Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. The Kate Hamilton Mystery Series is about an American antiques dealer in the UK who solves crimes and mysteries. But how did a Columbus-based author get inspired to write about antiques in the UK? Connie Berry, award-winning author, was raised by antique shop owners and developed a love for history, art, and travel, which all influences her writing. And she joins us today. Welcome to All Sides, Connie.
Oh, thank you, Amy. I'm delighted to be here.
So you recently released your sixth book in the series. Congratulations.
That's right. Thank you.
So it's called A Grave Deception. Now, without spoiling anything for our listeners, can you give us a little bit of the plot of this new book?
Kate is an antiquities dealer. She works with a gentleman called Ivor Tweedy, who is an antiquities expert, and they have been asked to appraise grave goods found with a 14th century miraculously preserved body that was discovered by an archaeological team from the University of East Anglia. And in the process of that, Kate is asked to see if she can find out who this 14th century woman was, and possibly because she was murdered, that is what they find out when they do the forensics, why she was murdered. It seems like an impossible task, but Kate agrees to try. It's kind of right up her alley. She loves that kind of thing. And in the meantime, more bodies turn up.
And then there's a grave deception, hence the title.
Yeah.
So whenever you're writing something like that, though, I mean, do you do research to figure out whether a body from the 14th century could this actually happen? Or do you just use authors?
I do extensive research. In fact, that was taken from a real event. There was a body discovered in Cumbria in 1981, I believe, by an archaeological team. And it was a 14th century body, and it was miraculously preserved, so much so that the corpse still had liquid blood in his chest.
Oh, fascinating.
And the archaeological team briefly thought they might have stumbled upon a modern, body. But his name was St. Bees Man, B-E-E-S, which was the location. Mm-hmm. And I was just fascinated by that. I stumbled upon that, and I just thought that was really cool. And then I just thought, well, what if Kate were to stumble upon that kind of a body? And then I had to figure out why she might get involved. And I discovered that grave goods possibly buried with a body, they might be asked to appraise it, which was unusual because by that time, people weren't burying objects with bodies, but in this case, they did. So that's where the makeup part comes in.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. So let's rewind a little bit and talk about the whole series. What inspired you to start this? The first book in the series is called A Dream of Death.
Yes.
In 2019. So where did this come from?
I grew up in the antiques trade, so I've always been interested in that. I've always been just fascinated by history. I've always loved stories. I wrote stories as a child. I was here at OSU getting a master's degree in the 1970s. And so I loved looking back into history, looking back into the literature of history. And so I wanted to have it set in the UK. I have Scottish grandparents, and they came over as adults. And so when I would go to visit them, it was a little bit like going to Scotland because they brought their culture with them. They didn't assimilate too well. They kind of kept with all Scottish people. So I had that background. And then I went to school briefly in England at St. Clair's College in Oxford and just kind of fell under the spell of the British Isles then. So I wanted to do that. So I wanted to have it set there. And one of the things that inspired me to do that was my thesis advisor here at OSU, and I wish I could remember his name, but I can't. And he told me when I was choosing a topic, be sure and choose something that you feel comfortable with, first of all, something you know. And then secondly, choose something that you really love because you're going to be spending a lot of time in that and you want to keep yourself interested. So I use those two things. I chose something I knew, which is the antiques trade, and then something I loved, which was the setting of the British Isles. But my protagonist is an American because I feel comfortable writing through her perspective.
So you didn't make it entirely complicated for yourself by having it all be over there, but having the American be the main character.
The
right?
American is the main character. I always said, well, if I make mistakes, it's Kate who made the mistakes. but I do have a beta reader in the UK, and her name is Joyce McLennan. She was the private secretary for P.D. James for a while toward the end of James's life, and she reads my work and take some Americanisms out of the mouths of British characters for me, which is always helpful.
So is this the type of series where you need to read it in order, or can you pick up any of the six books?
I really think it depends upon the kind of person you are. There's some people that are a little bit OCD and who just can't think of starting anywhere but the beginning. But I've been very pleased with the comments that have been made in all my books where people say this can be read as a standalone. So if you read this one, you won't be confused. But if you want to start at the beginning because there is a larger arc, plot arc, character arc from the beginning.
And when you started in 2019 with the first one, did you know it was going to be a series or was it just one?
At that point, when I got my first contract, it was a two-book contract, so I knew there would be at least two books. But I had always planned for it to be a series, and so far, so good.
Yeah. So this is book six. Are there more to come?
I am working on a seventh one right now, so we'll see what happens. I also have book 4.5 is a novella. It is available as an e-book only, but it is part of the series as well. It's called Mistletoe and Murder.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the Kate Hamilton mystery series with Columbus-based award-winning author Connie Berry. Tell me a little bit more about your parents' antique shop, which influenced your books. Where was it located? Is it still around?
Oh, no. My parents are long gone. It was located in Rockford, Illinois, which is where I grew up, and it was actually my father who was the inspiration behind that. People always assume my mother was the antiques person and my dad came along, but it was the exact opposite. His parents, as I said, were from Scotland. He was actually raised by his Scottish grandparents who were caretakers for the Rockefeller family in their summer home in Lakewood, New Jersey. That's where he grew up and went through high school. And the Rockefellers collected Asian art and antiquities, and they weren't at that house very often, which is now gone. It's been torn down. But as a boy, my father was able to go into this large home. His grandparents were the caretakers, and he saw the room called the Chinese Room, and that's where they stored the beginnings of their Asian art and antiquities collection, and was fascinated as a boy with the beauty and the artistry and the time it would take to produce these objects. And so Asian art was always his first love. And he was the one who got my mother involved in it. And I always say, which is a joke kind of, but really not, it's actually true that they opened a shop not really because they were so interested in selling objects, but because they needed space to buy more things. So they always loved to buy much more than they loved to sell, but it was just a way to get things out. So our home was always like a staging ground. So objects would come and go. And for example, for quite a long time, we had a huge, like an 8-foot statue of the Three Graces in marble in our living room, just standing there, not doing anything. That went away, and that was replaced by a bust of Marie Antoinette.
Ooh.
And just all kinds of objects, which I thought was perfectly normal, of course. You know, mm-hmm. you always think that, but only as an adult have I learned that my friends thought it was pretty creepy.
No one else had a bust of Marie Antoinette, yes.
No.
So did you work in the antique shop? Were you an employee there?
I did, reluctantly. Mm. I wasn't that interested, but on Saturdays, I was pulled in to work there sometimes, and yeah.
So taking over the antique shop was not something you were going
to
do?
No, it wasn't. I think my parents would have loved that, but they eventually closed it. It was just... They were never, you know, that into selling things anyway. So and then they started selling privately. So they would sell to other dealers.
So what brought you to Columbus? Was it getting your master's degree?
No. My husband was in the Air Force. We got out of the Air Force and he got a job offer in the state of Ohio selling. And we decided that Columbus was centrally located where he could get to Cleveland and Cincinnati and Dayton and Toledo and... You know, all the other areas pretty quickly.
And then why'd you stay? Is it home now?
Yes. My husband has a business and it's centered here. But since I was here, I'd wanted to go to graduate school and Ohio State was just perfect. So I had a wonderful time.
Did you say your master's degree, is it in creative writing or what?
It's in English literature.
Mm, okay. Okay. So, yeah. So writing the books that you're writing, did that come years after your master's degree or was it one and the same?
That was years after, but I've always written. I've just loved writing, but mostly nonfiction. I wrote, I did some historical writing. I published an article in the Hudson Valley Regional Review about a Civil War soldier from Vermont. I've done a lot of editing. I've done a lot of business writing, things like that. So actually switching to fiction, which was my first love because I just love stories, was a little bit of a transition because in nonfiction writing, you're always trying to pare down, clarify. And in fiction writing, sometimes you have to embellish a little bit. You have to set the scene. You have to... set the characters. So, but it was a fun process.
The A Dream of Death, your first book, it won the, is it called the Ippi Gold Medal? IPPI, Ippi Gold Medal for mystery. And it became a finalist for both the silver, I don't know how to say
Falchion.
It. Falchion. Yeah. And the other one I can say, the Agatha Award. So, and then your fifth book, A Collection of Lies, was nominated for Best Contemporary Novel in 2025 for the Agatha Awards. So congratulations on all that.
Yeah, thank you.
How does it feel to gain attention through these awards? Especially, I mean, the Agatha Award, you know, that's named for Agatha Christie. That has to mean something. Yeah.
The one I'm most proud of is the Edgar. I was a finalist for the Edgar Award.
As in Edgar Allan Poe, yeah.
Uh-huh, yeah. Edgar Allan Poe. And I was... a candidate along with Robert Thorogood, who writes the Death in Paradise TV show. And he has since, neither one of us won that year, but it was very fun to be among that group. That's the good thing about being traditionally published is that you are eligible for national awards. And it is gratifying to be noticed. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And tell me about your fan base. Is it Americans who like British mysteries?
I think mostly it is, of course. Although I am gaining readership in the UK, which I'm very glad of. And also just looking at the library statistics, which I don't do normally, but I have done, the book is placed really all over the world. You know, Germany, France, Australia. Africa, South America.
Okay. And we talked about this already. You're a relatively new author. So what did you do before you decided to make writing your full-time job?
I had a career for 25 years. I taught theology for an organization called BSF International. Mm-hmm. I had a large class, somewhere around 600 to 800 women who would come. And it was a series of courses that I taught. So that was wonderful. During that time, I was writing for part of it. I was writing part-time because my main focus had to be lecturing. I would lecture and also train leaders. And then when I retired in 2016, I decided to go full-time writing.
And you mentioned that you're working on a book 7 for this series.
Yeah.
Do you plan on writing any other books that are outside of the series? Do you have another character in mind and not Kate?
Yeah, I do actually have a lot of ideas in mind, more than I can probably do. But I am also working on a historical set in Buckinghamshire in 1829. So I'm interested in setting my books in the UK. But there's a lot of possibilities.
How often do you need to travel over there for research to see something face to face?
We travel over there once or twice a year, and we were just there in October. I'm not sure when we're going back because we're going to Norway in this coming October, which is one of my where I have relatives.
And then are you going to set a future book in Norway?
I don't think so.
Okay. We have been talking with Columbus-based award-winning author Connie Berry, and her newest book is called A Grave Deception. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you. Nice to be here.
And coming up, we're going to talk with a local entrepreneur who is expanding to work with a network of nonprofits and small businesses in Columbus. That's when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Originally a lawyer, Derek Pinnell broadened his career to include being the owner of a jazz club, and now has transformed an old warehouse into the Center of Entrepreneurial Development, known as CoEd. The center is playing an integral role in the Black community as a growth opportunity for businesses in Columbus. And joining us now is Derek Pinnell. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So a Columbus Monthly profile described you as a serial entrepreneur. So if you started out as a lawyer, how did you end up a serial entrepreneur?
That's interesting. I actually started out as an entrepreneur. At 14, I couldn't be a lawyer. but I started cutting grass at 14 years old, just around the neighborhood. By 19, it was when I first started, I was Derek's Grass Cutting Service. By 19, it was Pinnell's Landscaping and Lawn Maintenance Company.
Oh, you made it some more sophisticated.
Listen, I had 18 staff, trucks, trailers. I actually had the landscaping company while I was in law school. And even when I was in there, I was telling my colleagues, I don't really want to be a lawyer. I just want to be an entrepreneur who knows the law. But after, finishing, and then I went into entertainment law. So then I went out to L.A. I was a sports agent with NFL and NBA music industry. So I said I might as well use a law degree, but still have my own firm. So entrepreneurship was always a priority. So I didn't really have to transition from a lawyer to entrepreneur. I just continued on an entrepreneurial path.
Well, so it was like coming back home, both figuratively and literally.
Absolutely. It was.
So, because that same Columbus Monthly profile also called you generational to Columbus. So explain what that means. So you were in LA being this, fancy lawyer, but then...
I wouldn't say fancy lawyer. Because as soon as I finished, I came back. So I was actually here while I was, I got the experience because I think in the early 90s, when I would like intern at the courthouse and things like that, is when Snoop and Tupac and all of them were going through their challenges with the, legal system. So I was there watching it and being in L.A. just right after the riots and seeing all the things that was going on from a legal standpoint. It just helped shape my perspective from the legal field. But I always knew, you know, business is what I was going to do. So I came back and, you know, OSU was like a hub when it came to, you know, football. Mm. So, you know, I started talking to some of the players and working with some of them. And it just, it really helped. But my career has always been right here in Columbus. I just literally went to school, then came home.
So what landed you in deciding to start the Blue Note?
So my father was a jazz musician, mm-hmm. As well as an educator. My mother was an entrepreneur. And so fast forward, you know, I actually teach entrepreneurship. So mm-hmm. I got the best of both worlds. But growing up in an environment where jazz was every day, all day, mm-hmm. you know, I played trumpet. You know, I was in the band. And so I loved it, had a passion for it. And then I think as paying homage to my pops, you know, I just said, you know, let me open up a jazz club. Plus, at that time, the time I opened, which was in January of 2020.
Oh, that's bad timing.
Oh, it was terrible timing. I mean, 3 months later, yeah. you know, I remember seeing the governor on the news saying, you know, all bars and clubs and restaurants must shut down. And I'm thinking, we're 3 months old. But we're still here. We're still here. We made it. And as a matter of fact, we opened a second location in September, and we're opening a third location on Ridge Street this year.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. My next question was, you recently expanded. How are you doing? But obviously, well, I didn't know about the third location. Tell me about that.
It is on Ridge Street, right next to River and Ridge. Mm. You know, it's a mixed use building, has apartments on the first level. It has retail shops, but just to the left of it are two old buildings with graffiti all on them, with two catwalks connecting them. And so I had an opportunity to purchase those and felt like, you know, with the expansion of Franklinton, a lot of the residential developments that were going on, I felt like a jazz club would be great there as well.
And I read somewhere that you've said, you know, there's always room for more jazz in Columbus. So is three locations going to be enough?
I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. I've been approached by some of the developers around town that just recognize, I think, the not just the importance of the preservation of jazz, but just how fascinating it is, because so many is cross-generational, is cross-cultural. I mean, you can, at any given time in any of the locations, you'll see different ages, different races, just people really enjoy jazz.
Mm-hmm. Are they all going to have the same name, or is the third one different?
So right now, it's Blue Note on Main, mm-hmm. Blue Note on Town, mm-hmm. and then it'll be Blue Note on Rich.
All right. You got to stick with the branding.
You got to stick with the branding.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Derek Pinnell, owner of the Blue Note Jazz Cafe and two others, and also the entrepreneur and founder of the Center of Entrepreneurial Development. So let's talk about that. You took an abandoned warehouse on Main Street and turned it into the Center of Entrepreneurial Development, also known as CoEd. What will visitors find when they go to that space?
Wow. An experience, in a word. It was 40, about 45,000 square feet, four stories. It was pretty much like four buildings that were all conjoined. Mm-hmm. And then I went in there and just, you know, I saw vision, felt like, hey, we can do something special with this. We built it out. It's offices, co-working spaces, an event space that holds 200 people. We right now have about 88 tenants, all entrepreneurs at different levels. And I mean, from lawyers to creatives, there's a whole floor dedicated to creative arts. Most of the people on that floor are either visual artists or in fashion. Mm-hmm. There's authors. There's a music production studio, photography studios. We just the gambit. I mean, if you're trying to start a business, you know, the design was first to bring in the tenants that would serve as subject matter experts, mm-hmm. so that when we opened it up as a co-working space, they had people that they can lean on and learn from, you know, because really just looking at the pillars that were necessary or that were missing in the community from an entrepreneurial standpoint, like the lack of education. So it was important to get people there that can help educate folks on entrepreneurship and finance and banking and those things like that. And then the lack of cohesiveness from a community, you know, mm-hmm. just Most communities support one another. In our community in particular, African American community, it's been a challenge because we've been taught to distrust each other. So just really getting behind each other has been a challenge for our community. So we kind of show that. I intentionally put businesses that do the same types of businesses together, like next door, and kind of sit down and talk to them about, listen, instead of you getting a small contract and you getting a small contract, why don't you learn to collaborate and go get a bigger contract? And it's really helped because that's what we do. And this is such a spirit of community. You don't have the competition and people looking over their shoulder and wondering, what are you doing? But it really is, you walk in there and what do you do? Let's figure out how we can work together. So just learning from other cultures what works and trying to incorporate that into our community.
And it sounds like when you consider what an entrepreneur is, it's a lot of different things. So it's not someone trying to start necessarily a business, because you mentioned authors and artists. What's an entrepreneur to you?
To me, it's something that it's someone who decides to just takes their gift, their talents, to another level where they can share it with other people. There's some entrepreneurs who still work 9-to-5s. And I always tell folks that it's purpose driven. So if you understand, why you're here, and then it kind of puts you in a position to figure out, what do I need to do in order to grow that gift or grow that talent and share with other people so they can benefit from it. That's, in my opinion, moving in an entrepreneurial space.
And I saw on your website that your hours, you're open late, too. So if someone still works a 9-to-5 and they're running their second business, their dream business from 5 to 9, they can be there?
Absolutely. The tenants have 24-hour access. So in any given time, there are people in the building. I don't think there's ever a time when no one's in the building. There's some people who specifically work like third shift, if you will, on their business. I have my oldest son. He has his own clothing line. Shout out to Works of Madness. He's 25. He did over $2 million in revenues last year with about 30% margins.
That's not tiny.
It's not tiny at all, right? And so my wife and I, along with both our sons, who are both entrepreneurs, 23 and 25 years old, respectively, we were in New Orleans for New Year's. And so we go to the mall. We went in the shop, and my son's clothes, his clothing brand, is in the shop.
Oh, how
and
fun.
And they recognized him right away. So it's fascinating just to see the growth of them. The other one's a music producer, and he's already at 23, worked with national recording artists, and he's doing well in his own right.
In the past, on All Sides, we've spent some time talking about the economic disparities minorities face. And in your opinion, how is Columbus doing at being a welcoming environment for growing Black-owned businesses?
I think it's doing well. As I look at the increase in minority-owned businesses. But like most places, there's a lot of room for growth. A lot of barriers still out there, even from a capital acquisition or banking. I talk to a lot of heads of banks and just express there are, we can be nice and say intrinsic bias. We cannot be so nice and say discriminatory practices. But, historically, it's when you're looking for a commercial loan, particularly, it's based heavily on assets, where our community, on average, I think the Black family has about $17,000 in assets, where our counterparts may have $170,000 on average, which is a huge disparity. And so when you go to get a commercial loan, they say, okay, based on what you have, we'll give you about $10,000 with a high interest rate, versus $100,000, which could really help a business scale. So just trying to work with banks, because we know there's people in our community who have rented for 20 years and maybe $1,500 a month, never been late. But that's maybe the equivalent of a $200,000 house. But it's not weighed the same, just really trying to get some changes like that made, where people can really understand that there is a disparity, that there has been wrongdoing intentionally in the past, and let's try to correct it.
We did a show recently, and Columbus City Council member was here talking about the ground floor growth initiative, wanting to put businesses into the ground floors of downtown, get more business downtown, and the focus was on getting Black-owned businesses in there. And he mentioned your place as being a great incubator for, you know, the business to get a start so that they can be in this storefront downtown. Do you envision the businesses moving away from you? Do you want them to leave?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're not in the business of being just an incubator that keeps, like a hospital incubator. You never want a baby to stay there. Mm. You know, you want them to outgrow it. And I love it when we have tenants who will start out with a cubicle and then they'll say, hey, I need my own private office. Mm. Now I need a bigger office. Hey, we have some tenants who have like a half a floor. Mm. And to watch that growth. And then even some to say, hey, I really need my own building. And we're very instrumental in helping them get that because that's what we're there for, to really see the growth. And so we definitely welcome people growing outside of here. And I've actually assisted in that process with putting those businesses downtown, because it is a viable location. It can do well, you know, but it's also important to assist them with that process, because sometimes it's not just saying I'm downtown, you know.
Well, it's a gamble. Downtown rent is huge, and are there enough workers? Do the businesses come before the workers? The workers come before the businesses? It's hard.
It is. And historically, a lot of African American entrepreneurs build a business focused on serving the African American mm-hmm. community. Mm-hmm. And if that's not if there's not a lot of African Americans downtown, you know, you're setting yourself up for failure. So one of the things that I help those businesses that are looking to move downtown is really diversifying, you know, their base and say, listen, you have to come up with something that everyone's going to love, like jazz. You know, so that was my little plug, right?
Just as an example.
Yeah, absolutely.
For example. when did you open Co-Ed? When did the warehouse open?
So I bought the building in November of 22.
Okay.
And there were no HVAC, so we didn't do anything during the winter months, you know. And then in 23, I started building out the second floor, and then one of my colleagues and I, she had an office, I had an office, and I sat there for about a year trying to figure out what I was going to do with this huge building. Mm. And I would say, so in 24, we decided to start building it out. And as of today, it's completely built out 100%. Mm. And so we'll probably do our grand opening in like March.
See, you're talking about it like it's been open for decades, but it's new. And what you're doing is new. Yeah.
It is new. And we have a waiting list. You know, we're at 100% occupancy.
Wow.
And we have a waiting list. So we love helping the businesses that are on the cusp of outgrowing to move on.
You're like, now it's time for you to leave.
Yes. And what I've done, being a developer as well, is in two different large areas of the building is built second stories where there were no second stories. So we're going to build as much as we can. And I'm working with, a couple other developers now to expand even within that facility, some more space.
You're already ready for a co-ed too, like how you made Blue Note 2 and 3.
I have been approached by some folks, not just here, but in other cities, other countries, as far as doing a co-ed. So we've changed our website from columbuscoed.com to coedworldwide.com.
Oh.
So it's coming.
Okay.
It's coming.
All right.
The need is there. The demand is there.
Okay. Okay. You got to come back and tell me about that expansion.
I definitely will.
We'll be tomorrow at the pace you're going.
Exactly. I've been told that.
Okay. So but if you're at 100% capacity, but you still have these offices and these meeting rooms, so people can rent them by the day, right? So you're not like. Full, like people, like someone who's listening right now could go on and be like, I need an office for like a few days here and there.
Absolutely. So the 100% occupancy is the tenancy. Mm-hmm. So we had tenants first. We built those out. And then now we opened it up for the co-working space, like a co-hatch or WeWork. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of capacity for that.
Okay.
So we'll probably cap that at maybe 300 members, just to kind of monitor how many people are coming and going, and then we'll go from there. But we have, even for those members, we have a full fitness center that they can utilize, comes with the membership. We have a massage therapist. Mm-hmm. We have a meditation room, which has 2 zero gravity chairs. with a fountain in it that you can just reserve for 30 minutes at a time and just decompress. A rec room like pool table, video games, just really thinking about what can we offer, you know, people who are entrepreneurs, you know, still struggling with the day to day hustle and bustle, but they can also break from the norm and say, you know, hey, I go in here, I can work out, I can take a shower, I can go back to work. And probably the only thing that we would look to expand upon is maybe some type of childcare facility within so that there's no excuses for you not to be there.
I am having a hard time picturing how big this building is as you keep naming more and more things. I mean, is it like a full city block? Like how big?
It pretty much is.
Okay.
It is. It's a very big building. Sits right on Main Street near Nelson, right next to the train tracks.
Okay.
I
only saw pictures of it. Now I need to go drive by.
And just the one block west of it, right at Main and Fairwood, I've purchased the entire block, and in three commercial buildings sit on that lot, and that'll be like an extension of co-ed. We already call it the annex.
How do you have the time for all of this?
I make the time. You know, I sleep 2 a.m. to 6 a.m.
Okay.
That's my window, and that's all I need, and I'm not tired throughout the day. Just give me those 4 hours, and I'm going to work the other 20.
Wow. I'm tired just talking to you, but I'm impressed, impressed.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Derek Pennell, entrepreneur and founder of the Center of Entrepreneurial Development and the Blue Note Jazz Cafe. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to talk to a Columbus author who writes all about Ohio food. That is when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Renee Castile-Cook has written 5 different books about food, from the history of ice cream in the Buckeye State to food trucks scattered all across the U.S. However, she doesn't just focus on the taste or the recipe. She makes sure that her readers know the history of the dishes that they are reading about. And as it turns out, Ohio food history is as rich as the dish's flavor. And Renee Castile-Cook is here today to tell us all about her work. Welcome to All Sides, Renee.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
And I just wanted to start, what inspired you to start writing about food? Where did, you know, there's a million things people can write about. Why food?
Yeah, so I actually have a background in advertising, and I've worked on a variety of different food and beverage clients from McDonald's and Burger King, as well as partnerships with Xbox. And also, I just, you know, really enjoy the topic myself. My husband sells wine. They pair quite well together.
So when you write about various desserts or confections, you often draw a lot of attention to the history behind them. So such as one of your books is Ohio Ice Cream, A Scoop of History. What made you want to investigate the history of ice cream?
So Ohio has a really rich dairy heritage. At one point, there were over 2,000 dairy farms in the state. And when you have enough milk, you make cheese, you make yogurt, then eventually you have the technology to make ice cream. And so it was a really fun experience to actually go to the library at the Ohio Historical Center and learn more about how ice cream first came to America and then to Ohio based on that rich dairy history.
So tell me a little bit about that. Like, where's Ohio's place in the ice cream world compared to other states?
Yeah, so very early, actually. We invented not only the ice cream cone, but novelties such as Good Humor, obviously. And that might have been the first ice cream truck. I think it was the first ice cream truck. That might have been the first mobile food truck, which now we have a very rich scene, you know, in the mobile food industry as well.
So tell me, what's the most interesting thing you learned about ice cream in Ohio when you were writing your A Scoop of History book?
I love the story about the ice cream cone. So the Mensch's brothers, who are also credited with inventing the hamburger, were said to be at the World's Fair in St. Louis. And one of them was courting a young woman who wanted to try ice cream, but was afraid to drip it on, you know, the beautiful gown that she likely sported to the World's Fair at that time. So they were also making waffles. They had a machine and they poured a really thin layer of batter on top of it. They grabbed what's called a FID. It's spelled F-I-D, I believe. It's actually the stake that holds a fair tent. And they wrapped this waffle around the FID, let it cool, scooped her ice cream into there and handed it to her so that she could try the novelty. And I just love that story of creativity, innovation, on the spot thinking, you know, and being able to serve someone something in a new manner.
And inventing the waffle cone. How about that? which is a favorite in my household. My daughter loves a waffle cone. And then related to the ice cream book, do you go through, do you get to Grater's and Jenny's and that kind of thing?
Of course, we'd be remiss not to include, you know, our household names and some which have become national brands. Absolutely. But one of the things I wanted to do was make sure we also represented the rich heritage of mom and pop shops, you know, the roadside stands that probably going to make some people hungry for their favorite one right now because they're not open in January. But, you know, the guys that open Memorial Day to Labor Day and support the Little League team and all of your fun summer moments. So I think we did a really good job of running the gamut from mom and pop shops all the way up to our national brands that started here in Ohio.
What do you enjoy most about food writing, besides probably getting to taste things so before you write about them?
Absolutely, taste testing. I got some really fun taste testing stories. I actually received a giant shipment of ice cream on Halloween night, and it was packed, of course, on dry ice. So when we opened it, it looked like the witch's cauldron. I have young children as well who love ice cream, and their candy went to the side, and they, you know, opened all the pints of ice cream and had to sample them immediately. But beyond the taste testing, what I've really enjoyed from the very first food truck book through the Ohio Buckeye Candy book is telling the story of these producers, you know, and why they got into this craft and what makes their product very distinct and unique from one another's. When I first started the Buckeye book with my publisher, I said, isn't a Buckeye just a Buckeye, just a Buckeye? I joke that I'm not a Buckeye by birth, but by choice. I actually came from Chicago and moved to Ohio about 11 years ago. But I've really just been inspired by these small businesses and these entrepreneurs, you know, like the Buckeye lady who started her business during the pandemic with the original stuffed Buckeye. And, you know, for decades, everyone had just been making the traditional Buckeye the same way. And Alicia really put a new spin on it, and her business has grown exponentially since then. So I find a lot of fun in meeting the people and telling their stories.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with food and travel writer Renee Castile-Cook. So let's talk about that Buckeye. The Buckeye is poised to likely become Ohio's official state candy. There's a law going through the Ohio State House related to that. Why do you think that both the plant and the candy have become so popular here?
Well, you probably have to attribute a lot of that to, you know, that college football team or just that college in general and all their teams embracing that as a mascot. But the classic combination of peanut butter and chocolate really just drives that home. I've loved Reese's Peanut Butter Cups since before I was a Buckeye. And so when I was introduced to, you know, the first one I had was from my mother-in-law, who at one point was making them with a team of women from her church. They made 5,000 every fall for their annual church bazaar. So, you know, not only is it a wonderful product, but it brings people together, and it's a celebratory thing for football games, for holidays. I absolutely believe, you know, we should instate that as the state confection.
Now, who invented the Buckeye? Like, put the peanut butter and the chocolate together in that perfect shape?
Yeah. So there's actually a little controversy over this story. The woman that invented the Buckeye originally was not a student at Ohio State, but her husband was. And when they were going to leave, her name was, Gail Tabor Lucas. And when she was going to leave Ohio, she had a friend that she had met through his community of cohorts in the program he was in. And this woman asked her for the recipe. She said, Gail, we have to have it at future events. Can you please share with me? I won't share it with anyone else. So they moved to Arizona, where Miss Gail becomes a reporter, and they come back almost 10, 20 years later. And she finds out that other people are making the Buckeye. And she's like, well, how did this ever happen? You know, who shared my recipe? And they said, oh, well, not only did so-and-so share your recipe, she actually printed it in the Ohio State Magazine with her own name on it.
Oh.
So there was quite a bit of, you know, it wasn't the way technology obviously flows today. She hadn't gotten word of that quite yet. Well, she printed an article in the Arizona Republic reclaiming the origin story and her recipe of the first Buckeye candy. It was actually a riff on a Buckeye or a peanut butter chocolate ball. It wasn't originally called the Buckeye, obviously, that was fully enrobed in chocolate. Mm. And her mom had made that recipe and sent it to her. And when Gail dipped it in, she only did 3/4 of the way and turned to her husband and said, doesn't this look like, you know, the useless nut that falls all over campus and the mascot? And he said yes. And so, you know, it's a fun origin story. A little bit of controversy is always a good time in there, too. But we owe our credit. And the recipe in the book is from Miss Gail Tabor Lucas.
You also write about food trucks. One of the books you have is about Columbus and is a cookbook. The other book travels to a few different cities. So let's start with the local one. Why a cookbook instead of a history book when it comes to food trucks?
Yeah, so that book actually came first and was the product of the fact that I had moved from Chicago to Columbus. Mm-hmm. And at the time in Chicago, you weren't able to cook on a food truck, on a mobile, you couldn't do mobile preparation. You could serve from it. So we ended up in Chicago with about 400 cupcake trucks and no actual food. And I came to Columbus and I realized, wow, there's an incredible diversity of cuisine. You know, we are a test market based on all my work in food and bev professionally. A lot of those QSR restaurants, quick service restaurants, we colloquially call them fast food, have either they're from here, like Wendy's and White Castle, or they have test locations in Columbus because of our economic and socioeconomic diversity. And so if something does well from a food perspective in Columbus, it'll probably do well in most of the country. Columbus, though, from the years about 2010 to 2014, went from 40 to 400 food trucks in a very short period of time, rapid explosion. The city really embraced and supported those business owners and those entrepreneurs. And I wanted to share those stories. I had come across a series called Trailer Food Diaries when I was traveling in Austin, Texas. So the follow-up book, The Best Of, is actually a best of Trailer Food Diaries. My co-author, Tiffany Herlick, had written about 3 books about Austin, 2 books about Portland, Oregon. Those are considered pretty much food truck mecca cities. And then some other markets in Texas where she's based. And so we brought them all together and incorporated Columbus in that because I really wanted people to see that, you know, we are critical to the food truck movement as well as a city that has great representation.
The book, The Best of Trailer Food Diaries, the subtitle is Serving Up the American Dream One Plate at a Time. So tell me what you learned about the American dream from writing this book.
That's all Tiffany. I won't take credit for that one. That came with the series. And I, you know, I love it. I embrace it. I think it really extends across all of the writing that I've done in space because, as I said, a lot of these are small business owners. They're entrepreneurs. They have an idea about something that maybe they're pulling from their heritage. We have Fetty's Street Food, where the owner, Damien, he had come from South Africa. He actually had a mobile truck there, but he was making like hamburgers and hot dogs because in South Africa, people, you know, they're used to having the Bauer sausage and the curries and the different dishes that he does. So when he actually fell in love, got married and came over to America, when he settled here, he realized he could do the food of his country and introduce Columbus to that and they would embrace it. And if you haven't had it, I can highly recommend it. Something totally different than kind of, you know, what many of us are probably used to. So I think serving up that American dream, you know, being able to come own your own business and share your cuisine is really exciting in that format.
So what's next? What food is next? Are you working on a next book?
So I'm not currently writing about food. One of the five books that you referred to is actually a children's book called Meet Maddie. And so my tiny taste testers would like a sequel to that. And that is my current pursuit for right now. I'm always open to more topics. You know, cupcakes and donuts have been suggested. They're not quite ownable to Ohio, so we really would be looking for something that Ohio either has history in, much like the ice cream book, or true ownership of, like the Buckeye candy. But, you know, I'm open to suggestions, so send them my way.
And we have about a minute left, but let's mention the picture book. It's called Meet Maddie. What inspired you to decide to make your most recent book a children's book?
So that book was in between some of the food books, and my daughter at the time, she's 10 now, she was much younger. She just had this crazy fashion sense, and I've always loved monkeys. And so we brought those two things together. It was really fun because I had some connections to Barnes and Noble through the original food truck cookbook, and we were able to do a little book tour and do children's story times. And it was just a really special moment for us. My illustrator on that book was actually a 14-year-old at the time, and it was a fun partnership for him to bring that to life through sort of the eyes of not quite still a child, but you know, not too formerly in that space.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I had your books out of order, but
That's
we have a
okay.
few seconds left. So what's the next children's book going to be called? Do you have it in the works?
Yeah, so after my oldest, I have twins, and so this one will be Maddie Meets the Multiples.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's cute. Okay. All right. How far away are we from having it?
We are fingers crossed for sometime mid-year.
Okay. And is it the same artist, or did you find another 14-year-old?
Actually, I reached out to him, but we are leveraging some technology this time. So I'm excited to see how that comes to life
All right.
based on his originals. Yeah.
We've been talking with Renee Castile Cook, who has written several books about Ohio food and beyond, including children's books. Thank you so much for your time today, Renee.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
And you've been listening to Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. If you missed any part of today's show, listen back at wosu.org/allsides. Subscribe to our podcast, listen on our mobile app, and also be sure to follow All Sides on Facebook and on Instagram. This is 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.